Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Lawmakers started making significant budget cuts this week. Then Democratic leadership said, whoa, wait a minute.
I just don't see the need to do, to go down there and cut to the point where people's lives change when it doesn't have to yet.
Political reporter James Dawson joins us to explain this latest twist in the state's budget drama. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from an expert on where things stand in the battle against the opioid epidemic. Learn more about a politically charged art exhibit in Wilmington. I meet a young man who's outrunning the challenges he faces living with cystic fibrosis. Plus, we have our latest installment of History Matters. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, lawmakers on the Budget Writing Joint Finance Committee set to the work of making cuts that would address the state's over $380 million shortfall. But a day after making $30 million worth of cuts to education, the arts, and public health Tuesday, Democratic leaders in both chambers put the brakes on the JFC's work Wednesday. Political reporter James Dawson reported on this latest act in this year's budget drama this week. And he joins us here on The Green to explain exactly what's going on. James, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
Well, let's start with the cuts. What was on the block Tuesday? It seemed like education was really a big focus of JFC.
Yeah, we got a lot here. So you're right, education took the biggest hit, about $14.7 million in total. So JFC took an axe to the State Board of Education itself, which had been under consideration elsewhere in the General Assembly, getting rid of it entirely. The committee also cut a lot of programs championed by the previous governor, Jack Markell. So that included helping students cover college application costs, helping take the PSAT and a so-called teacher leader program. Elsewhere, they cut several budgets by about 20%, including an infant mortality task force that has been around for a while, a nurse family partnership program for new mothers, and a program fighting sickle cell anemia, which most commonly affects African Americans.
And these cuts were not made without some opposition on JFC itself, right?
Yeah, so typically JFC votes on a lot of these cuts in blocks, but they had to piece a lot of these out. So a lot of the no votes came from Democrats who said that these programs have helped families in need, whether it's a disabled veteran or an underprivileged kid. But only a handful of them were put on hold. In all, JFC cut about $80 million over the past couple weeks.
But on Wednesday, Democratic leadership told JFC to stop. What was the rationale of leadership coming in there and saying, hey, put the brakes on here?
Well, they were getting yelled at over the phone by voters and fellow lawmakers over the cuts that were being made. So that had a lot to do with making that decision. But as for the rationale, House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf says that JFC shouldn't be making these cuts right now without a full tax revenue plan in front of them. House Republicans signed off on a bill that would raise the corporate franchise tax. That still has to go through the Senate to be official. And then still up in the air, though, are hikes to the personal income tax and some so-called sin taxes, including alcohol, tobacco, stuff like that.
Is this an unusual move for leadership to make, to say to JFC, you know what, we want you to stop what you're doing and we'll get back to you?
Well, I'll tell you that I haven't seen it in my 5 years covering the General Assembly. Senator Harris McDowell, one of the JFC co-chairs and the longest serving member of the state Senate, says that it's not uncommon. But reporters and observers I've talked to say they haven't seen anything like this either. It is possible that it could have happened when JFC was meeting behind closed doors and just so, you know, the public didn't see it happen.
But this was a very public kind of a display of, hey, stop the boat for a second. And that is something that, as you said, it doesn't seem that a lot of people have seen in the past in the General Assembly. The focus now shifts to taxes and whether or not a deal can be struck that can stave off some of these more draconian cuts that JFC could make. What are you hearing right now about the status of these negotiations to get the revenue side, the other piece of the governor's shared sacrifice plan?
Yeah, it's not necessarily negative. So Schwarzkopf says talks are going well. They just haven't been finalized. Senate Minority Whip Greg Lavelle says there's still plenty of time to get any kind of a deal done, but then he wouldn't comment on the status of the talks directly. And that's different from what he told me a month or so ago, where Democrats would have to look at things like seriously reforming Medicaid, for example, or prevailing wage before the Republicans would go to the table. So they're scheduled to meet every Tuesday up until the end of session. We'll see how that turns out.
Is there a sense that that someone JFC wanted to kind of start just making these cuts and not leave it all to the end, not have to wait for these revenues to say, hey, we're going to do this, and then if we have more money, we'll go back and change things back if we need to?
Yeah, that was the wish of the other co-chair, Representative Melanie George-Smith. She wanted a plan on the table by the end of this week. Obviously, it didn't happen. And I think it speaks to, you know, the Speaker and the pro tem's power over the members of the General Assembly in general.
Having said that, are we more likely to see this now drag to the very end of the session and some kind of last minute late night deal June 30 into July 1?
I mean, it sure seems like it. So even with a new tax package, JFC will still have to cut a decent amount to get a balanced budget. And at least if they want it to look anything like the plan from Governor John Carney. So the committee had wanted to put out a final budget, like I just mentioned, by the end of the week. There's still 4 weeks left until June 30th. Republicans generally like to wait until the final state revenue forecast comes out. That's going to be June 19th this year before they make any sort of concrete decisions. And keep in mind, the bond bill and grant and aid bills still have to be finalized, too. So there's still a lot of work to be done. It's going to be compressed if they don't find something probably within the next couple weeks.
And you'll be watching it for us. James Dawson, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And remember, you can keep up with all of James Dawson's coverage of politics in the First State online anytime at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We look at the status of fighting the opioid epidemic here in Delaware. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Fentanyl and federal funding cuts to addiction treatment programs. Those are two of the biggest threats to Delaware's ability to subdue the opioid epidemic, according to Dr. Terry Horton. Dr. Horton is the chief of Christiana Care's Division of Addiction Medicine and an internationally recognized authority on substance abuse. He testified before a U.S. Senate committee on the opioid epidemic last week and told lawmakers this is the worst possible time to cut health care funding. Delaware Public Media's James Morrison caught up with Dr. Horton following his Senate appearance to talk more about what can be done to fight the opioid epidemic.
You appeared before the U.S. Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs last week to provide testimony on the opioid epidemic, and you stressed the importance of addressing fentanyl use. So how is this exacerbating the opioid epidemic?
Well, fentanyl is an opioid that's about 50 times more powerful than heroin. It's manufactured in, actually chemicals that are used to manufacture it come primarily from China, brought into the country, and then are transported to Mexico and Canada where they're manufactured into fentanyl, then brought into the country. It's very, very cheap, many more times powerful than heroin, and then it's used as part of the mix by drug dealers to enhance the power and improve their profitability. The danger is it's much more likely to cause overdose. But I'd also mentioned that in my testimony, that was only part of my concern. I was as concerned that with the current changes being put forth by the American Health Care Act and our president's proposed budget cuts, as well as some of the deliberations in the Senate to reduce particularly Medicaid, but by having those reductions really threatens our ability to treat patients with heroin addiction. And if that comes to pass, we could be seeing really horrific amounts of death in our communities.
And this would be the combination of funding cuts for programs like Medicaid and also the repealing the Affordable Care Act in exchange for the American Health Care Act.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, we're looking at and somewhere in the ballpark of $1.4 trillion being cut. And it was estimated that in Delaware alone, over 10 years, we could lose $2 billion. Now, our health system, particularly the health system that had been designed to assist with drug treatment, is not flush with money and opportunity. It's we're really still trying to build that system out. And if that system is gutted, I really foresee the collapse of the public health programs. And with that, in an inability to treat drug addiction, we're going to see really horrific overdose deaths in the next year or two.
And you did say in your testimony that the opioid epidemic it's critical, urgent, and getting worse. And there has been this increased attention to it. So why is it getting worse despite all of this, people paying attention now?
It's one thing to pay attention and talk about something. It's another to fund it. So we've seen a lot of talk and a lot of, I think, well-intentioned efforts towards communicating the peril that is happening and the causes for worsening addiction. We've seen regulatory efforts to reduce the access of prescription opiates in our communities, and those are all good things. But the genie's out of the bottle. So not only do we have a prescription drug issue, but now we have a heroin epidemic that's complicating that. Individuals who were originally exposed to prescription drugs are now switching over to heroin, and separately we have individuals who are starting with heroin. So in our communities we're having both prescription drug epidemic, heroin epidemic, both of which can have fatal outcomes.
So what are some of the solutions, things that could help? I know it sounds like from what you've said that funding is definitely critical.
Yeah, we're actually learning how to manage better and opiate withdrawal and identification of individuals who are opiate dependent and in need of care. And here at Christiana, for example, we've started to screen all of our medical admissions with very simple two-question screener, and we have automated through our electronic health record the ability to identify opiate withdrawal quickly and bring to bear treatments to address that opiate withdrawal very, very quickly. And at that moment, if we can treat the withdrawal, we can help use that to leverage them into care. And we've been very successful. You know, 2/3 of the patients coming in opiate withdrawal will agree to go into care and then work with us on medications like Suboxone, like methadone, to move into drug treatment programs in the community. And we've been very successful. In fact, our first group of patients that we studied, 2/3 were agreeable to getting into care. Of those individuals, more than 3/4 of them showed up to the first appointment in the community. And of that group, 70% were there a month later. So we've figured out ways to identify these individuals who are opiate dependent on heroin and prescription drugs, address their withdrawal, use that as a means to get them into care in the community. And if you're in drug treatment and you're on Suboxone in the community, you're not going to overdose.
I wanted to just touch on real quickly these three new bills that the governor signed into law this week. And kind of a brief overview is that they help the state keep a closer eye on people who might be overprescribing opiates through the prescription monitoring program. And it also helps make sure that insurance covers addiction treatment. So in your view, is this a step in the right direction? Is this enough to kind of get Delaware going down that track to battle the opioid epidemic?
Yeah, certainly you need a broad approach. You need to be able to continue to monitor and make sure that controlled drugs are prescribed in a responsible manner. We really have to preserve access to drug treatment for those who have this chronic disease called addiction. Without that treatment, we're going to end up with individuals relapsing. And relapsing nowadays with heroin is often a fatal event. So any bill that is going to ensure that individuals are covered, that insurance companies have to provide that coverage, is something that I support. More so now in the face of what we've seen from the American Healthcare Act, where some of those protections for those with individuals with mental health and substance abuse issues, protections to ensure that they're cared for like other medical problems, the AHCA does away with those protections. So I think our state is being very smart in trying to preserve what is kind of absolutely critical part of this of any solution.
With these proposed cuts on a federal level and the fate of the Affordable Care Act and the balance unknown in the future, do you see it as possibly coming down to states, cities to have to basically take on the opioid epidemic at this level?
I think that's the absolute intent from what we're seeing in Washington is to really wash their hands of this issue and push it on to the states. States are already impacted fiscally and not in a position to take more on. And so that could be catastrophic. So when you hear about block grants and And the notion that states will have more latitude to address a problem locally is, in my mind, is kind of buzzwords or code for we're just going to wash our hands and we're going to let the states pay for this. And the amount of dollars that they're projecting to give to this issue are really pale in comparison to what's needed.
That was Delaware Public Media's James Morrison speaking with Dr. Terry Horton, chief of Christiana Care's Division of Addiction Medicine. He testified before a U.S. Senate committee on the opioid epidemic last week. And The Green continues in a moment with a new History Matters. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Summer is the time many families hit the road, heading to the beach and elsewhere. But many vacation destinations like Rehoboth Beach weren't always a welcome place for African Americans, and simply traveling on the open road during the segregation era wasn't very safe for them. In this month's History Matters, produced in collaboration with the Delaware Historical Society, Megan Pauly tells us the story of a safe haven guide created specifically for African American travelers called the Negro Motorist Green Book and its connection to the first state.
The year was 1954, and Don Blakey was headed from Washington, D.C. to Dover to attend Delaware State University, then known as Delaware State College. Blakey doesn't remember feeling the impact of segregated life in D.C., but says that changed once he reached Delaware.
You felt it when you got off the train in Dover.
He arrived before Labor Day weekend that year, and school didn't start until after the holiday. So to pass the time and make some money, he and some buddies drove down to Rehoboth Beach, where they worked as busboys in the white-only hotels and restaurants. That's where Blakey heard about Rosedale Beach, a resort and hotel owned and operated by African Americans for African Americans. After a long day at work, he'd head over to Rosedale, where he could relax and listen to some jazz from some of the great musicians of that time, like Louis Armstrong, Ray Charles, and Ella Fitzgerald, all night and into the wee hours of the morning before resuming another day of work.
Can you imagine Duke Ellington's orchestra leaving Philadelphia and traveling all the way to Rosedale? Well, Rosedale was not the primary place. It was Rehoboth where they actually played for their funds. But they were going to have to leave there and try and find their way back home on these dark Delaware roads with no signs, no lights, and police all over the place. So someone said, why don't you go over to Rosedale? They can put you up. Welcome. Can you play for us? And they said, yeah, we'll do a whole set for you. Well, they play for the opportunity to have food and a place to sleep. Now, that becomes a drawing, a magnet for customers. Duke Ellington's going to be here this weekend. Count Basie, and everybody's flocking to this place.
And when Duke Ellington and others played that second set at Rosedale, Blakey said boats full of white people would pull up near the beach shore to listen to the music as it drifted out to sea. Not only was Rosedale on the Chitlin Circuit, a national circuit of performance venues that were safe and acceptable for African American musicians, comedians, and other entertainers, it was also listed as a vacation spot in the Negro Motorist Green Book.
Because it was a safe area, and that's what they were. The Green Book was outlining safe areas for African Americans to drop in on, to stay, get comfort, get information, feel good, and then move on to the next.
But entertainment venues like Rosedale and the Rodney Hotel weren't the only Delaware safe havens listed in the guide.
Gas stations, restaurants, barbershops, beauty salons.
That's Carlton Hall with Delaware's Division of Cultural Affairs, listing off examples of some establishments included in the Green Book. Hall began researching Green Book stops in Delaware in 2014, such as Randolph's Nest Restaurant, operated by Joseph Randolph and his wife for over 30 years in southern Delaware.
Two doors down from Randolph's Nest, which was the restaurant, he had a tourist home, which he named Randolph's Rest, with an R.
Tourist homes were like the bed and breakfasts or Airbnbs of today. Most tourist home listings in the Green Book had live-in hosts. Hall says it's likely there were many additional tourist homes that existed in Delaware, but that weren't listed in the Green Book, but instead utilized via word of mouth.
And when I talk about the Green Book, a lot of people think that there are all of the listings in the area, but they're not. They are only the listings that the owners decide that they want to advertise in the Green Book. So the Green Book's not a definitive list, just those who chose to advertise.
Today, Hall gives presentations about the book across Delaware. He describes the book as being about the same size as a Jet magazine.
And you would have listings, and you'd have a vacation section, and you'd have a little bit about the owner of the guy, Victor Green, who started the Green Book in there.
Calvin Ramsey, a New York writer and playwright, began looking into Victor Green's legacy after he came to know about the Green Book at a funeral in Atlanta in 2001.
The grandfather came down for the funeral, and the grandfather was African-American, his first time in the Deep South, and he thought he still needed a Green Book. After the service, he mentioned that he was looking for a Green Book, and I said, well, what's that? And he started telling me all about it.
Ramsey says Green realized there was a need for such a travel guide while making trips every year to visit his wife's family in Richmond, Virginia.
I think that's how he knew how hard it was on the open road for blacks to travel. And from that experience with her, a Jewish friend gave him the idea that maybe he should start a travel book of his own, so the Jewish community had their own travel guide as well.
Green launched the book in 1936 in the New York metro area, eventually expanding its reach to 46 states. During that time, he kept his day job as a union postal worker, using his connections in the National Association of Postal and Federal Employees to expand the booklet's listings.
Just like today, the mail carriers know more about our neighborhoods than anyone else, and they would screen people in there on their routes, who to ask, who they thought may have an extra room or a house that could accommodate people traveling. So it just grew from there. There was no phone numbers in the Green Book. It was just addresses.
Eventually, Green's business got so big he had to move it out of his home and into an office space. He also utilized the emerging Esso gas stations network to help advertise Green Books. In New York alone, Esso employed at least two African-American representatives whose sole responsibility was to advertise the books. Blakey says he thinks that's how his football team's bus drivers discovered safe spots for the team to frequent while on long journeys to and from away games.
When we left in the morning, like at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we were going to Charlotte, North Carolina, which we could have made in one day, we stopped 4 hours after we had begun in Richmond. And I, at that time, I didn't understand it. I would say, maybe we're just stopping for a break. But it was a safe haven stop to stop in Richmond, downtown Richmond, at the same restaurant for the whole 4 years, where we could eat, we could discuss our plans for the game, we could talk about education and other things, and it was safe.
Blakey met his wife, Dolores, at Delaware State. She was a cheerleader who helped make sandwiches and snacks for those long trips and welcomed the team home.
It was great. Under those circumstances, it was still, that was great. It does not happen today because the people on campus, the young people on campus, don't even know the team is gone. Or when they return, they only know that they played a game. It was a different situation altogether.
Gone, too, is the need for temporary beds Blakey would make up for visiting teams in attics and abandoned buildings. Rosedale Beach has also disappeared. Blakey says it was severely damaged by a hurricane in the early 1960s, and with segregation illegal at that point, they didn't rebuild.
I can go anywhere, so why would I want to go here? I'll go to Rehoboth. I'll go to Lewis. I'll go to this place. So now I can't rebuild because I don't have the customer base to provide the money to rebuild, so they close.
The Green Book continued after Victor Green's death in 1960, lasting until 1967, thanks to his wife and an all-female staff. Hall says the language on the book's covers in the last few years of its existence reflected the still hostile environment that continued after Brown versus Board of Education.
You still have for vacation without aggravation. And 1964 is, you know, right around the Civil Rights Act and, you know, basically, at that point, you know, segregation is not really the law anymore, but it wasn't really enforced, so we still kind of had difficulties.
And Ramsey says Victor Green envisioned a time when the Green Book would become obsolete.
He felt like one day the laws would change and blacks would have open accommodations on the open road and the Green Book would no longer be needed. He was looking forward to that day, but then he knew that blacks would be treated as full-fledged citizens like everyone else. So he was doing the Green Book as a necessity. He didn't want to do it forever. He was just doing that to help.
The Green Book's legacy is being preserved with many copies digitally cataloged and available for viewing online through the New York Public Library. And you'll find many Delaware tourist homes listed in the Green Book are still there at the address listed. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Megan Pauley.
Thanks, Megan. And check out all of our History Matters segments anytime at DelawarePublic.org. Next on The Green, a new arts playlist for you. This is Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Graphic designer and University of Delaware professor Colette Gaeter's work has always mixed politics and art. Her new show, Alternative True Facts, explores the current political climate in various works on paper, books, and even a deck of playing cards. In our latest arts playlist, our Mark Earhart spoke with Gaeter about her new show at the Mezzanine Gallery in Wilmington.
The title of your exhibition is Alternatively True Facts, you know, a nod to something President Trump counselor Kellyanne Conway said, defending false statements about the president's Inauguration Day audience. My question is, why use this as the title of your show at the Mezzanine Gallery?
Well, I believe that what Kellyanne Conway said is that the administration uses alternative facts. There are alternative facts. To be fair, I think what she meant was that there are many ways to look at the same thing and that, you know, people have a different perception of events, et cetera. So I twisted it to alternatively true facts. And the idea was to make you think about how the idea of what is true and what is not true is being challenged daily in the national news, and especially in the political news, and especially from this administration. I mean, people's heads are just spinning. You know, I just thought it was the perfect title for what's going on in the world right now.
And in your exhibit, you take traditionally reliable sources in print media, like books and headlines and things, and then you work that into your artwork. What will people see when they walk into the Mezzanine Gallery for this show?
The latest piece that I've made is a series of images that include haiku poems that are made from Trump tweets. And these are printed on pages of a book of birds that I bought when I was in Cuba. And each page has a bird on it. And it also has a Trump haiku from one of his tweets.
So a little tweet there.
Yes, exactly. So, and the title of that piece is A Little Bird Told Me.
So is most of the work in this exhibit politically motivated, politically influenced?
Well, I started my career as a graphic designer, but I've always been interested in current events. I always believe that truth is stranger than fiction. You can't make anything up that is more absurd, ridiculous, shocking than something that happens in real life. So that's when I started using texts. So I used texts right out of the newspaper, and I just thought, as an artist, it allows me to show things in a way that people might not see them otherwise. You can get on the radio, you can get on TV and say, well, you know, Donald Trump lied about this. But if you show the actual text with another text and with a compelling image that illuminates all of it, then you might be able to get through to some people who didn't see it otherwise.
And what other kinds of compelling images will we see in this show? Are they all works on paper?
Yes. There is a book that I made back in October, before the election even. It takes text from the How and Why Book of Electricity for Children from 1969, and it's all about how to be careful with electricity. And I took selected texts from that book and juxtaposed them with quotes from Donald Trump's speech at the Republican National Convention. So these texts are juxtaposed on top of collages in the background. So one of the things that is involved in this piece is I traveled to Cuba quite a bit. And one of the things I've noticed being in Cuba, and this is what gave me the idea for the whole piece, is out on the street, there are all these electrical boxes that are not covered. And often these wires are sticking out of the box and they're taped they're duct taped or sometimes with many colors of tape. And they're almost like little artworks. I just found them to be really fascinating. this phrase came in my mind, clear and present danger. Like there's these electrical wires just sticking out. So the images tie together the idea that there's something right in front of us, so we pass by it every day, that is extremely dangerous under certain conditions. You know, all you need is for these things to happen and you have a disaster.
The Trump administration has proposed some pretty massive cuts to government arts funding. Does that have any play in your show or your work as an artist?
Not specifically. I mean, that's part of the, I mean, to be honest, every single Republican, they've been after the NEA since the 90s, you know, maybe even before that. Maybe they always thought it was a bad idea. The arts and the humanities. You know, one of the things that is so troubling about that is, again, twisting of reality. The fact that people are interested in the arts and humanities and books and literature and higher education and ideas has been turned into elitism that's used against the masses of people. It's been presented as something that is harmful rather than enriches people's lives. And it also diminishes the fact that everybody participates in the arts and humanities in a number of different ways. More people go to museums every year than go to sporting events. Art museums, history museums, all kinds of museums are one of our more egalitarian institutions, in that most of them try to have at least some free access and free programming. There are lots of art museums that are completely free all the time. I just think it's diabolical, because denying people access to the arts and humanities and stopping the incubation and dissemination of ideas is what keeps people uninformed. And if you have to base your politics and your political success on people being uninformed, that is not a good thing.
So it's obvious the current political climate has informed your work, but are there other pieces in this show that have to do with other things outside of politics?
Yes. I made a deck of cards for an organization I developed with a colleague. Our project is the Beauty Shop Project Delaware, and it's about building women's self-esteem and helping women to take better care of themselves. The cards have quotes on them, like there's one from Hillary Clinton that says, "If I want to knock a story off the front page, I just change my hair." And there's one from Aretha Franklin that says, "I'm a big woman, I need big hair." So between the sort of humorous or inspirational quotes, they're real information about how women can change their lives.
And I have to ask, after doing a little research, I came across a piece of yours called Monkey Girl Weds Alligator Boy.
Yes.
What's this about?
Well, let me see if I can make this story short. I did some research into genetic mutations. I'd heard about this woman from Mexico who had a disease called trichosis, I think is the name of it, where you grow excessive facial hair. And back in the day, there used to be people called bearded ladies at shows and fairs, freak shows, I used to call them. I found this real story of this woman they called Monkey Girl, who was on the circuit in circuses. And she found this man who was called Alligator Boy because he had this condition that made his skin scaly. And they were married. They were married for a long time, happily married. And I found the story about it, which became the title and the cover image of the book. The book itself is a found wedding album that I found. I think it's a book of proofs from a wedding photographer for a wedding. I think it's from the 1940s, maybe, or early 1950s. It's a white couple. They seem relatively affluent, and the photographs show their extended families, all the traditional photographs of them cutting the cake, you know, posing with relatives, the bride and groom together, et cetera, et cetera. Kind of the fairy tale wedding story. So I took this story told through this wedding album and changed it to include people with various genetic abnormalities. And what I want people to think about is how all of our mating, you know, finding a mate, getting married, et cetera, is thinking about a genetic future. And on the back of the book is an ad, a real ad against miscegenation. And it goes, you know, interracial marriage and interracial childbearing. And it goes on to talk about how wrong this is and how, you know, that people shouldn't do it. I just think that this is one of these, again, one of these things that's out there in plain sight. You know, people, when they look for a mate, they look for someone who has similar background, usually same race, usually same nationality. It's that, you know, all these different attributes that they think will produce a good genetic line. So, you know, I kind of rolled all those things into one.
Is it meant to be humorous at first, but then people delve into it and see that it's got very serious undertones?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
Thanks to our Mark Earhart and his guest, artist and UD professor Colette Gaeter. Her exhibit, Alternative True Facts, is on display at the Mezzanine Gallery at the Carvel State Building in Wilmington through June 30th. And stay with us. We wrap up the show with this week's Enlighten Me. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Newborn babies in Delaware are screened for cystic fibrosis, a genetic disease where a thick buildup of mucus in the lungs causes infections and can obstruct breathing. Everett Meredith Middle School student Michael Caruso Davis was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis when he was 3 weeks old, but has overcome the challenges associated with it to become a star athlete. As a matter of fact, he's one of 17 athletes nationwide nominated for former NFL quarterback Boomer Esiason's Team Boomer Athlete of the Year Award. The competition features athletes who either have cystic fibrosis or know a family member or close friend who has it. For this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Katie Pikus introduces us to Michael Caruso Davis and his mother, Jen Caruso.
According to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation patient registry, more than 30,000 people are living with cystic fibrosis in the United States, and there are 1,000 new cases diagnosed every year. More than 75% of people are diagnosed by age 2. And I'm curious about the story behind Michael's diagnosis.
Michael was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis through the newborn screening, and we confirmed the diagnosis at 3 weeks old. It came as a shock to his father and I. I didn't know anyone in my family with cystic fibrosis, and neither did Michael's father. We had to do some digging through family history and things to try and find it. And we think we located it, the gene that is in Italy, through a distant cousin. That's how far removed it was from us. But from that point on, we rallied around Michael, of course, and we started a great strides walk for cystic fibrosis that we do yearly. And as the years have gone on, Michael has gotten involved in his own CF awareness through running and raising money as well.
And Michael, can you talk about the challenges of living with cystic fibrosis?
So living with cystic fibrosis is very hard and emotional. So every morning I wake up at 4:30 in the morning and do an hour of breathing treatments, which involves numerous inhaled medications, a vest that I put on that vibrates and breaks up the mucus in my lungs. Throughout the day I swallow over 40 pills. I do treatments 2 to 4 times a day. If I'm feeling good, it's 2. If I'm sick, it could be up to 4. So I could be doing from 2 hours of breathing treatments to 4 hours of breathing treatments a day. It's sometimes interferes with like going outside or playing with friends or going to play sports, but I've never let it stop me.
And what keeps you motivated on a daily basis?
Knowing that one day they will find a cure makes me want to raise more awareness and raise more money to hopefully make that day come sooner.
And Michael and Jen, what has your family done to raise awareness and support for cystic fibrosis?
As a family, we've done a lot for cystic fibrosis and raising awareness. We do our Great Strides Walk yearly. Michael runs in a 5K every summer that raises money to send a cystic fibrosis child on a wish trip. Last year alone, we raised over $50,000 for cystic fibrosis. So far this year for the Boomer Esiason Foundation, we have raised over $26,000 and counting. So we're very active in the community for fundraising. In addition to that, over the last couple of years, I've gotten more involved in advocacy, going down to Washington, D.C. and speaking with our congressmen and senators regarding the healthcare bill. And actually, just a couple weeks ago, Michael met with Senator Carper down in his office, and Senator Carper was nice enough to spend an hour and a half with Michael listening to his concerns. They actually had something in common. They both like to run, so that was a really nice meeting.
And Michael, how did you get into running in the first place?
A few years back, I started to run, and I noticed my lung function started to go up. So I figured if I keep running, my lung function will keep going up, which it has been. Last summer, I was supposed to go into a long-term treatment for bacteria that I had in my lungs, but I ran throughout the summer and did a lot of breathing treatments and a lot of medication, and then at the end of the summer, we decided I didn't have to do it anymore. So I just kept running ever since and decided to do the half marathon and 5Ks, and now it became something that I love to do.
Do you have sort of a daily running routine, or do you just go run hard until you're finished, or what do you do?
When I was training for the marathon, I had a daily routine that I would run. You know, one day I would run 4 miles and take a day off and then run 6 miles. I would train probably 6 days a week every week. And now it's just, if I want to run, I'll go run. It's not an everyday thing, but once I start training for the 18 miles and the triathlon, I'll be running every day.
You ran the New York City Half Marathon.
Yeah, I ran the New York City Half Marathon in March of 2017. I finished in 2 hours and 10 minutes.
What was that experience like for you?
It was very hard. The training wasn't that fun, but once I crossed the finish line, just made all of it worth it.
Jen, with your son saying that running really helped improve his health, he found something that he really loved to do and he continues to do it. How do you feel as a mother to really watch your son succeed like that despite the challenges?
So as his mom, I mean, I'm incredibly proud. I've always instilled in Michael since a young age that CF, although it's his diagnosis, it certainly doesn't define him, and that he can do anything he sets his mind to, and he's proven that time and time again. So just watching him run and raise awareness for cystic fibrosis and raising money for a cure and advocating the way he has been for healthcare, I'm just extremely proud.
Michael, I'm wondering if you could recall a time that maybe you thought cystic fibrosis could get in the way of something that you wanted to do, but you really pushed yourself to go forth and continue with it?
Last year, I was admitted in the hospital, and I had a small airway collapse, and then the cross season was still going, but I still went on the team, I still played, and still did everything the same way.
Michael, you were nominated for the Boomer Esiason's Team Boomer Athlete of the Year Award. What does that nomination mean to you?
I'm very honored to be nominated amongst the other great athletes who have CF and some who don't. They're all just great people.
And Jen, can you talk about what exactly this award is?
Sure. So this award recognizes someone either with cystic fibrosis or a connection to cystic fibrosis who uses fitness as a way to stay healthy. And especially with those with CF, it's just so important that they take their health into their own hands and they get out there and they run and don't let the disease take over, so to speak. And so being recognized for that dedication is an extreme honor. And we hope it sends a message, you know, to the CF community and those that might have cystic fibrosis that, you know, this is a really good thing and to get involved and to stay fit and active.
And Michael, how were you nominated in the first place?
I was nominated for Team Boomer's Athlete of the Month in June of 2016. And then after that, I ran the marathons and the 5Ks and just kept running. And then my mom told me one night that I was nominated for Athlete of the Year.
Winning this award, if that happened, what would that mean to you?
Winning this award would make me just very excited, and I would feel accomplished for everything that I've done to really be recognized for it. And
why?
Because I've done a lot for CF and the CF community. I've when I run, I think about all the kids that can't run and people that are laying in hospital beds who can't run. And I run for them and I run for the CF community.
Michael, what is your goal overall with raising awareness for cystic fibrosis?
In the end, my goal is to make CF stand for Cure Found.
So you're graduating eighth grade?
Yes.
So going into high school, is there any sort of plan that you have with either raising awareness for cystic fibrosis or even continuing to participate in athletics? What are your high school goals?
I want to play lacrosse in high school, and my goal is to start varsity as a freshman and become All-American.
Jen, as your son continues to live with cystic fibrosis, what makes you really, really proud?
I'm really proud of all Michael's accomplishments and overcoming the diagnosis that he has with cystic fibrosis. So as an example, last year he missed over 50 days of school and he still finished the year with honor roll. And again, he's missed a lot of school this year, but we've been getting, you know, our schoolwork from and instructions from the Appaquinmic School District. He's able to keep up. And actually his teachers tell me when he comes back from his missed school that he hasn't skipped a beat. And so we're very proud of that. And on top of that, you know, of course, he plays lacrosse and we love watching him play. He really puts his heart into it. And then all the running that he's doing and raising awareness around cystic fibrosis, I mean, I couldn't be more proud of him.
Who is your inspiration?
I have many inspirations. I have, when it comes to a CF standpoint, Jerry Cahill and Gunnar Esiason are my two inspirations. They've never let CF stop them. Jerry Cahill has had a lung transplant and hasn't been living life to the fullest. Gunnar Esiason is an athlete and has vlogs and was really active in the CF community. When it comes to running, Jay Aspero has always been there for me since the past year since I met him. And my biggest inspiration is probably my mom, my family, because I've always wanted to make them proud.
Thanks to Michael Caruso Davis, his mom Jen, and our Katie Pikus for enlightening us this week. You can read more about Michael and how to vote for him in the Team Boomer Athlete of the Year Award Contest at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all the time we have on this week's edition of The Green. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to the Greens page on our website. And remember, you can check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart, James Dawson, James Morrison, Megan Pauly, and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.